Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. Today is the third anniversary of the Inner Circle podcast. My guest today, once again, is engineer Dennis Moody. First, let's talk about Spotify Hi-Fi. I've been predicting for more than a year now that the streaming networks were going to go high-res, and this is now coming to pass. In the last week, Spotify has quietly rolled out some A/B testing for what they call Spotify Hi-Fi, and apparently it's going to be a lossless CD quality tier. Now, they're test marketing it right now, so what you'll find is certain people will find a price of $5 extra for the tier or $15 a month, and some will find $7.50 extra, and some will find $10 extra or $19.99 a month. The interesting thing is when they click on one of these, what they'll find is they'll either get an error or it will just say that it's not ready yet. So Spotify is testing the market. They're putting their toe in this to see what is going to happen if they introduce a high-res tier and how much they should charge for it. Now, other than that, there's absolutely no other news. There's no tech specs. We don't know if it's CD quality, 44.1, 16-bit, or 24-bit. We don't know anything about that. Plus, we don't know if, in fact, there's a FLAC wrapper or if it's ALAC or anything like that that's a lossless codec that they're using. So I guess we'll see pretty soon. But what this will do, it will force the hand of Apple. And of course, Apple has been collecting high-res files for about 4 years now. And we're going to see pretty soon Apple come out with a true high-res tier, because everything they're getting in is at least 24-bit, and they've been actually requesting everything at 96K. How much of that they're getting, I'm not sure, but they've been requesting it for 4 years. So we're right on the cusp of hi-fi, or high-res, I should say, coming to streaming, and we're going to see it everywhere soon. It's going to be the standard. You wait and see. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. The fourth editions of my Mixing Engineer's Handbook, Recording Engineer's Handbook, and Mastering Engineer's Handbook are now available on Amazon and soon coming to a bookstore near you. You can read excerpts and find out more details by going to bobbyosinski.com. Now, this last week, a couple interesting things happened. There were two big historic recording consoles that went up for sale. One was an API 36 input that came from Sunset Sound Factory. I don't know if you know this, but Sunset Sound, the famous Sunset Boulevard recording studio, and was actually one of the first indie studios way, way back in the 50s and 60s, actually, had a smaller studio still in town, a few blocks away, called Sunset Sound Factory. And there are a number of rooms in Sunset Sound Factory, but the primary room, the big room, actually had this beautiful API console that was restored in 1987 for quite a bit of money. And there was a number of very, very big clients that actually went through there. Chili Peppers, Sheryl Crow, Brian Wilson, Bonnie Raitt. There's all sorts of great people that worked in there. It was actually a budget room to Sunset Sound. So what you found is people that were at the end of their budgets on an album would go in there, or if they had a short budget for whatever reason, would use Sunset Sound Factory. But it was a great sounding room, and this console is now up for sale on Vintage King. Don't know how much it is, but it's in working condition. As a matter of fact, better than working condition. It's a 10 out of 10 when it comes to working, and it's a 9 out of 10 just in cosmetics, so you're never going to find a better console than this. That being said, how many people want or need a console these days? So that brings us to the second console, which is really historic because this is the EMI TG-12345 Mark IV from Abbey Road. If you know anything about Abbey Road, in the early days, their engineers, or boffins as they would call them, would actually custom make their consoles. And this was one of the custom made consoles. It was one of only two made. Now, the historic thing about this is Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon was made on it, as well as many other albums from Paul McCartney and George Harrison, Kate Bush, The Cure, just a whole host of very interesting clients recorded on it while it was in Abbey Road. And then it was sold to producer Michael Hedges, who had it in his personal studio. Again, it's up and running 100%. It works like a champ. 40 channels with a limiter and compressor on each channel, which is forward thinking for 1972, I think, when it was first built. 24 inputs and a 16-track monitor. So in other words, you got 40 inputs, but you have 24 on one side, basically, that has mic amps and a 16-channel for a 16-track recorder. Now, of course, these days, that's all kind of thrown out the window where we have hundreds of tracks, but usually when we're mixing on a console, we submix anything that we need from the box, so number of channels isn't a big problem. Now, the interesting thing about this is it's up for auction, which is going to be later in the month. The estimates are going to be that this will go for somewhere in the mid to high six figures. So basically, you're buying this console for the historical factor more than anything. There are many people that think that this is the world's best sounding console, that there was never a console that was better sounding than this one. That being said, I know a number of the original Abbey Road engineers, Ken Scott for one, who he told me personally that he thought the TG series, which were the transistorized series, were actually pretty bad sounding, and they didn't like it as compared to the earlier Red series, which were tube. And that's the ones that all the Beatles records were done on those particular consoles. That being said, you can't argue with Dark Side of the Moon, because boy, that's a great album and it still sounds terrific all these years later. So we'll see what happens with both of these consoles. It'll be interesting to see both who buys them and also for how much. This is the beginning of year number four of the Inner Circle podcast. And has been the case with every anniversary, my guest is engineer Dennis Moody, who was also my very, very first guest. Dennis and I go way back as we worked on a lot of different projects together over the years. If you don't know his background, he's both a live engineer mixing shows, go from arenas to clubs, and a longtime studio engineer. He's the favorite engineer of many of the drumming gods like Steve Gadd and Dave Weckl and Steely Dan drummer Michael White, which tells you all you need to know about how good he is. I spoke with Dennis via phone from San Francisco. Welcome to, this is the beginning of season four of the podcast. So this is episode 151. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be back. It's amazing how time flies.
Yeah, no kidding. For better or for worse on that one, huh?
Yeah. Well, it's been pretty better, actually. I don't have many complaints about how things have been going the last few years. But let's hope that they continue to keep that way and better. So anyway, yes, it's been okay. And thanks for having me back.
Well, let's catch up then. Where have you been this last year? Because I know you've been all over the world again.
Well, it's funny. Last year, 2016, hasn't been as active on the overseas traveling as the previous year. The previous year, 2015, I think I was out about 10 months, which was great to be so busy and in demand, but yet it kind of made my studio business just stop. So in 2016, I only did about 6 weeks of touring. In March, I went to Antalya, Turkey for about 12 days for a series of shows there with my Persian client, Gugush. And then at the end of the year, I went to Europe with her for a show at Wembley Arena on the 16th of December. And then we did one in Germany and we did one in Sweden on Christmas Day, all sold out shows. In addition to that, a three-day run with Keiko Matsui, the jazz pianist, I was home for the most part, just doing sessions constantly. So I wasn't actually gone that much last year, but people seem to think I was, so that's good.
Yeah, I think everybody's used to being gone. And it's funny because whenever we get in contact, it seems like you're just about ready to go out on the road someplace. It seems like you're always gone.
That's true, yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay.
I am now. I'm in San Francisco right now, actually. So.
Yeah, right. Well, you're doing a gig, right?
Yes, Yoshi's. Actually, Yoshi's Oakland. Yes, I'm here for a gig tonight. Yes.
Yeah. So what was the best gig? And it could be studio or it could be live. What was the best gig last year?
Last year, I would say did a record with a lot of recordings with various artists. One was with Tom Fowler and an artist named Marcus Messina. We were had a bunch of the Zappa alumni in, which was very thrilling to have Ray White and Bobby.
Bobby Martin.
Oh, Bobby Martin in. Yeah, that was really good. As well as Tom Fowler, who I've known for decades in working. That was quite a fun project. And another notable one was finishing up the Phil Norman Tentet record, which turned out incredibly well. It was actually had a one cut nominated for a Grammy that it didn't make it for the best instrumental arrangement. So that was quite nice to have. Just a whole bunch of little, all exciting. Every one of them has something different and interesting about it. So yes, it was a lot of fun projects.
Okay. So that being said, what was the worst gig? You don't have to name names, but what was the worst?
Most of them are trying to fix. Well, there's some live shows where you go and you do all the advance work to make sure you have the technical necessities you need to pull off a show. And you go there and it's like they never heard from you and they give you things that you didn't ask for and things you can't use. And then again, don't have the things you do need. So there's a couple of those. Recording wise, it's usually fixing horribly recorded projects. It's a challenge and it's kind of fun, but some of them are so poorly recorded. It's just like, if you can get it sound okay, you're lucky, but you know, that's a reflection upon your abilities. If people could hear the before and after, they would say you're a genius, but not hearing the before, they think it's the recording is like, I wouldn't say subpar, but not to your best, abilities. So those are hard to do. And they're a lot of work and they're not very rewarding at the end when people hear them and say, oh, that doesn't sound like a typical Dennis mix or something like that. And you're just lucky you even got that out, you know, to get a mix that works because of the source material. And I'm sure you're aware of that as an engineer and producer. You've had some of those. I won't say who it is. There are one or two of those I had to deal with this last year that were a lot of fun.
Well, I hear that more and more from mixers, though, that they're getting in what they consider subpar recordings. And instead of people going to a proper studio and doing it and using a real engineer, they do it themselves at home, only knowing the basics, and therefore they come out with, you know, what you have to fix and I have to fix. So, you know, there's the problem.
Yes. Right. Especially with drums, you know, I won't say who, but there's some of the top drummers in town are all at home now. And except for an exception like Weckl, who's a genius with sonics and recording and getting great sounds. Some of the guys I get tracks from, I go, no, this can't. Where did they record this? Oh, at their home studio. I go, no, it's not possible that someone of that caliber and notoriety is doing stuff so substandard. You know, it's not a good reflection on them. And they're big people. You know, their performances are phenomenal, but the way they sound is just, it's almost unusable. So that's a challenge. It's a challenge in, you know, just trying to make it sound okay, you know, and using sound replacement on certain elements in the kit and just trying to get it to work. And that's hard for us because we always strive for the best and we want our mixes to be just fantastic. We want them to sound, you know, people just to be blown away with what we do. And when you can't get that, it doesn't feel right. And it's a little disappointing, but we do our best and we still come up with good stuff. You know, it just takes longer and it's a bit limited, especially with the budgets today. You know, they aren't going to let you spend the hours that you need on it. It's just not financially feasible.
You know, I heard the same story from another friend of mine who has a lot of Grammys, and he was saying that he got some tracks in from a very famous drummer who did it at home. And this is someone who he's recorded a lot over the years. So he knows what he sounds like. He knows what his drums sound like. And, you know, he knows when he records them what it sounds like. And he just said, boy, the stuff I get in was so bad. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah. Yeah. It happens. But that's what they don't want to leave their homes anymore. You know, if they can get up in the morning and just, you know, go out into the garage and turn on the Pro Tools and record, then that's what they do.
Well, again,
just part of
you're getting it for cheaper too because of that. So, you know, price drives everything.
Yeah. No cartage, no studio charges, things like that. Yeah. It makes sense. So, but you know, it's just what we got to deal with now. So I just do it. I do my best and try and get them to sound presentable. And it's funny. Sometimes you improve it so much that they just can't believe this is not possible. You know, how did you do this?
Yeah.
A lot of dicing and, editing and stuff, but we do it. It's fun. It's a challenge. Part of the job these days.
Okay. So what are the trends that you've seen in the last year? And this could be live or in the studio. Was there something that struck you as a trend?
Well, there's two things that I've noticed, especially, the first one would be the budget being cut, and this is a hard one for me because I'm out in the audience, you know, sitting in my mixed position, and I still see, you know, if it's a smaller jazz tour, I still see 200, 300, 400 people there every show. Bigger shows, I still see 5, 6, 7, 8, 10,000 people every show, but you're always getting the complaint, the budgets are less. And I go, well, I'm sorry. I'm not very good at math, but I'm good at mathematical genius, but I can sit out there in the audience and say, okay, there's 250 people here. And the only difference now is that, 5 years ago, they were charging less for tickets. Now they're charging more. I know that they're beating down the backline companies and the, production rental houses. So they're actually getting all this gear cheaper than they got it years ago. So I don't buy into it that there's problems with the money when I see this, you know. So, but they're always, I'm getting this a lot now, like for crews now, you know, we're using house, lighting guys now and house monitor guys now. We do not bring a monitor guy or a lighting tech because it's just not affordable. So that's where we're at right now. That's one trend I see that's going on. Another one is job duties and requirements. When I started as a sound engineer, I would show up with the band. They'd be setting up. I'd dial in some presets on the analog console. They'd start playing, and I'd get the sounds. In 10, 15 minutes, we would have our sound up ready to do the show. And then when the show was over, I'd leave with them and go hit the bar. You know, now, because I think there is there's an overload of engineers out there looking for jobs, they're offering to do more work unrelated to being a sound mixer than they and doing additional duties for less money just so they can get the job. You know, so they have to be a tour manager now when I do sound on a lot of these, and I go, I'm a sound engineer, I'm not a travel agent, but this is part of the job requirements now.
Wow.
So this is what you do. Yeah. And this is very frustrating. And this is why I'm not taking a lot of those tours. With some of the acts I did in 2015, I was more of a travel agent than I was. Mixing was the smallest part of the job. So I just said, no more. I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm a sound engineer. I feel I'm really good at what I do, and there's no need for me to do that stuff. So I've been turning down a lot of things now. So that's a trend that's kind of bothering me. lately. And it's kind of disappointing, you know, because unless you're at the top level, even at the top level, you're required to do extra duties now. But at the top level, at least they compensate you financially for the extra work in a fair way, you know.
Yeah.
So those would be two things that I noticed that are pretty drastically different than in the previous years.
Well, I mean, it's the same thing even in the studio where, you know, what we were talking about before, when it comes to mixing, there's so much that you have to fix that once upon a time would be fixed by the time it got to you. So there's a lot of production
right.
decisions where, you know, you'll have 10 tracks of something, of a guitar, and they leave it to you to figure out which one to use. And it's like, well, why didn't you guys figure that out before you gave it to me? I don't need 10 tracks, you know? So
yeah,
lots of stuff. Or editing, where there's ticks and pops from bad edits that you have to go in and fix and things.
Oh, like yeah. That, you know? Yeah. Well, that's funny. A lot of that stuff, I know some guys are still using Pro Tools 9, which saved the crossfades in a fade folder. And when you switch to 10, it does real-time crossfades. So it doesn't have that folder with all the crossfades. So I go and say, wait a minute, I did all these crossfades on there. Should be no pops, ticks in that. And then I found out that someone else worked on it on 9. And when they come back to me, I lost all the crossfades were gone. So that's, that's one thing. I couldn't figure out why did they undo all my, how did that happen? And then of course, obviously the real-time crossfades. So that's one thing.
Well, let's go there for a second. Pro Tools. So what version are you on?
I'm on 10 and very, very soon switching to 12 point, 12.7 now? 12.7,
so.
I think.
I think, yeah.
I'm going to go up to the top one and just go for that. And the reason being is that I'm getting so many sessions coming in now that are 12 and such that, incompatibility is not working. In other words, the plugins, I can get the session open fine, but none of the plugins are compatible, or very few are compatible. So, you have to, as a professional, you have to, offer up-to-date services and gear, you know. So I'm trying to, I need to keep up with it. And I got up to in sync with 10, and then all of a sudden 11 and 12 came in just immediately after. So I'm getting ready to do that change probably in the next month. I'll be going up to 12.
Have you considered anything else?
A different system? No, I'll stay with Pro Tools. I thought about it, but I already know Pro Tools, and I'm very good at Pro Tools, and I can get it to do what I want it to do. So, and everybody, you know, it seems to be the standard now, so most people have it, and I'm not saying it's anything about the quality compared to the other DAW systems, but it's just what seems to be out there in the forefront. So I have to kind of stay with that to maintain a professional standard, you know.
Yeah.
So no, I'm not going to change at this point.
Okay.
It takes too long to learn all the little idiosyncrasies and stuff to learn them. It's too much, too much to learn being so busy, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Well, okay. We hung out at NAMM together for a little bit, which was very cool.
And yeah.
Always a pleasure.
See you there.
We didn't talk too much about gear though. What did you see there that you liked?
Well, I was there the first 2 days, and there were a couple interesting things I saw. And I have to say that the warm audio stuff is just stuff. I may have mentioned this last year when we were talking. It just really knocked me out with the quality of these products, their WA76 limiter compressor and their other Pultec emulator. EQ, it's the I can't remember right off the end, but it's their Pultec clone, let's say, and they've just been wonderful for me. Those products I've been just using constantly in my studio on recording. I didn't see anything that really like stood out exceptionally that just really blew my mind. There are a lot of for live. There's a lot of new in-ear systems, so wireless in-ears that are pre-molded and fit to the client's ear that are coming out. But and they're much less expensive than the big ones. But I. Trying to find out why, and when I look at them, I see the little differences. So I was pretty excited about that at first until I started looking, and I go, oh, well, this is why this one costs more than this one, because it's not offering as much. There are a couple microphones that I enjoyed. The MA-1000 seems to be a really great mic. Dusty's letting me try one out now. I have to evaluate it. I haven't had a chance to really even sit and A-B it against anything sessions I've used it on. It's been great.
I think you'll like that. It's Mojave Audio MA-1000, and it's their 251 C12. I don't want to say clone, but it's their kind of version. And boy, it sounds really good. I don't know if it sounds just like one of those, but...
No,
it doesn't matter. It doesn't have to. It sounds great.
You're right. Yeah, you're right. And the session I used it on, I did a session. I'm doing a session now with a couple of guys from Shalimar, and Mickey Free is a guitarist and vocalist. And it's kind of fun to work with those guys from that era because of the good old days stories that we talk about. But well, I used it on Howard Hewitt, who was the lead singer for Shalimar. He came and just... I couldn't believe how great the mic sounded. And again, I didn't put up another mic to compare how much more improved it may be compared to like a 414 or a 87, but it sounded awesome, really awesome. And I'm real happy for Dusty that he's got that out there because it's such a great product. I'm probably going to end up getting one here. I just have to go over the budgets and the need for it, you know?
Yeah.
So once I go through that, I may end up getting one. Another mic that really knocked me out was the Warm Audio 87, the W87. And you know, you get these email here, click this link to hear it. And I said, okay, I know Bryce over there and he's been really supportive of me and, helping, you know, I'm using his products, but you know, of course there's no more freebies. They don't give stuff to you. You buy it and you use it and you give them some feedback and help them to improve the quality of their product by your feedback, professional feedback. So I clicked on a link to check out the W87. I couldn't believe the sound of it. I sent him an email after and said, man, are you onto something? This has got to be one of the greatest sounding new affordable mics I've heard in years. As usually see those and go, okay, it sounds like a mic. Sounds like someone singing. But this mic just blew me away with the sound. So I'm probably going to try and pick up a pair of those too when the need comes later in the year, or maybe not so later in the year, maybe soon.
Yeah.
I just have to have need for them.
I listened on the floor, which is very difficult to really evaluate anything, but I have to say it sounded really good. I mean, it just had something that you went, oh, wait,
yes.
Okay, yeah, I get it. Like you say, you can listen to microphones on the floor and they sound like a microphone. They sound whatever you expect, but this just had something a little extra, and I'd love to hear in a real studio environment to find out if...
Right, well, I'll
really
let you know.
Yeah.
When I do. And it's really funny because I went back online to find that video clip that I saw the original, and I found some shootouts where they're comparing it to an 87, and it doesn't sound like an 87 in my opinion. There's a difference in the mid-range, but that's not a bad thing. As you know, it doesn't have to sound like the other mic. I mean, I could hear it distinct, the changes, something in the mids changed, but it's good. And I mean, if you're just listening to that mic, it just sounds awesome. So I'm really excited to, you know, about the possibility of getting a pair in and just using them to compare them on like drum overheads or for vocals or, you know, on my piano. So I'm looking forward to that. So very great product.
Did you notice all of the in-ear monitors? Well, you mentioned before about in-ear monitors, but it seemed like everywhere there was in-ears. I mean, even Fender was coming out with in-ears,
mm-hmm.
which right. makes me think that pretty soon we won't be seeing too many floor monitors around.
I don't know. You know, some I'm not sure about that. You know, I mean, the old school people still use the floor monitors. The good thing about in-ears is you can run a track with a click in there and nobody hears it. The phenomenal thing about using them is the communication on stage communication. When I was doing when you came to the Honda Center, when I was doing the two Persian singers, the band leader had a mic that only went to their in-ears for the lead singers. And in doing so, he could say, okay, here's your cue, or he'd count them in on their vocals where they were, you know, a little iffy at times. He'd count them in, he could talk to them, and they would hear everything he said, but you couldn't even tell this on stage, you know?
Yeah.
And that's a good thing about in-ears. But there's still people who like floor monitors. So here's an example. When I started working in this business, I worked for Paramount Recording, which is owned and built by Brian Bruderland back in the 60s. And Brian's brother, James, is married to Barbara Streisand. And she's having problems with her in-ears she hated him. He said, why aren't you touring? So I'm like, I just can't stand this with the in-ears. And he tried to get me on board with that, but unfortunately, at that level, there's a lot of politics involved with the production of that stature. But they finally talked to her, and they got her very comfortable with her floor wedges. She had, I don't know what she was using, but they're small cabinets, probably D&B, I would guess, because they'd have to be like top D&B or one of the other high quality boxes. And she had like five of them around her in a little semicircle, and they were on different parts of the stage wherever her scene would be. She had three areas set up, and she was very happy. But she was the point, from what he told me, that she didn't even like to tour, because she just hated to have to that struggle every performance of just trying to get to hear properly. So I think there will always be people that will go with the floors regardless, but I don't think it would switch over completely. But then again, with Gugusha's band, we have a flute player. I can't get the feedback issue. He can't hear himself without getting it up loud enough over the band and his floor wedge. So he's going to be on in-ears, and I can't wait. Our first show is this weekend in Houston with him on in-ears, and I'm going, great. I can't wait to get rid of that ring and feedback from him. So there's certain instances where they're just really useful and helpful, and there's certain things where the people just, they don't want to use them.
See, what I think is, now that they're so inexpensive and they're so prevalent, they're so easy to get, that you're going to start to see kids using them, you know, in garage bands and stuff. And once it gets to that level, then it's like, and then also what it does is it means that guitar players and bass players don't even have to have an amp. They don't have to push air on stage. So
yeah,
once that sort of happens, then I think that will all change. I'm not saying that floor monitors will go away. There'll always be a place for them for sure. But on the other hand, I think that we're going to see a shift where everybody's going to grow up with them.
You know, that would be really nice, is make the front house mix really great. You know, it would really be nice to be able to mix. It'd be almost like in a studio where the loudest thing on stage is going to either be your drum kit or your vocal, you know, and even with drums, you know, they're going to, you know, a lot of guys are using pads. I wouldn't say in the kind of music I do, but, you know, the jazz and the real music stuff. But I think in the future, they could go to pads where they're just all in-ears. You don't hear anything. You don't hear anything on stage except the singer singing, which would be phenomenal.
Yeah.
It'd be really fun to meet something like that and see. Well, here's an example, too, though, about that. The drums, I just did this. I'm working with Keiko Matsui now, and she has an acoustic piano, and she has a drummer who's right behind her, he's a great drummer. But, you know, drummers, when they get excited, they play loud. And when you have an acoustic piano 3 feet in front of the drum kit, even if it's closed, you still get leakage into it. So we put up a glass plexi shield on his in front of his kit, and I had hoped it would be a 4-foot shield because he was on a riser, but they brought in a 6-foot shield and it covered his toms. I couldn't hear his acoustic kit in the room, and it really bothered me. Really bothered me to see him hitting. I could hear his cymbals, but I couldn't hear his bass drum, and I couldn't hear his snare drum or his hi-hat. And it was, everybody said it sounded phenomenal, but to me, I was missing the ambience of the performance. It was like it was coming out of the speakers instead of off the stage in the position where you would expect to hear it.
Yeah, right.
So
right.
That was a little odd for me. Yeah, it was a little odd for me. But back to the in-ear thing. Yeah, you could be right. They could be moving that way. And, you know, you pick them up $100, you can pick up something now, you know. And some of the smaller companies, or, you know, the consumer companies like Behringer and companies like that are going to start throwing them out there with great quality stuff for, you know, $100. So, yeah, you could be right. We'll be seeing a lot more of that, which is a good thing.
I don't know if you saw it, but Ultimate Ears, they make custom IEMs. They had a box that I thought was brilliant. It was called Tap It. And what you would do is you take the cable that was running to your floor monitor and go into this box that would sit on your mic stand, and then you plug your in-ears into that. So basically you didn't have to worry about using a transmitter.
Wireless.
Yeah, you didn't have to worry about being wireless at that point. And you can control the level, and then there's even an output that you can go to a floor monitor if you wanted. But I thought, man, that's brilliant. It wasn't a lot of money. It was like $300 or something, but it's like, wow. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. I'll have to check that out. I did see a company that was offering something really cool that just really knocked me out with the in-ear thing. Going back to that, was they had a little box that was a belt pack, and you put your in-ears into that, and it had the ear buds actually had a little microphone on them. Instead of an acoustic port, like UE offers, Ultimate Ears offers a little port. There's a little hole drilled in there, so it's an ambient port. It actually lets real sound through. But these had a little microphone up there, and then you'd go into a little belt pack box where you could actually control the blend. So what would happen with these, when you have closed in-ears, they put up couple microphones, and the monitor engineer will blend that in, as you know, in between songs to your liking. But if you turn your head, it doesn't turn with you. The ambience doesn't turn with you. It's not in real time. It's stationary, but you're turning. So that bothers a lot of singers.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it'd be really weird. I couldn't imagine being up there on stage and turning my head and not hearing the audience change. It would be kind of uncomfortable, but these have the little mics in the back of the earbuds, and then you can do the blend on your belt pack. And I said, that's incredible. I want one of those. And it's that small and it fits. And they go, what's its wireless? What's the wireless capabilities of this? They go, oh no, you have to plug this out of this into a belt pack. And that's where it lost me, you know, because
yeah.
Have a singer, like a female singer up there with a tight outfit on. You can't have a bunch of belt packs around your back and under your clothes. How are you going to change it? You know, if you want to change the blend while you're running or up and down in between songs, it's not possible. So I said, keep working on this and I'll come back and check you next year and see if you can get it all in one, and I'll get one for sure. I can't remember what the company was, but I'm sure if they perfect that, they'll really be onto something. It's got to be the next big thing in in-ears, in my opinion.
Yeah.
It'd just be phenomenal. Also, a smaller receiver, a sender, a smaller belt pack for the in-ears. No receiver on the belt pack. They're pretty big now, and if they could get them down to about the size of a matchbox, it would be pretty incredible. So they still have a ways to go on all this stuff, but they're getting there, and each year I go there, I see small improvements. I'm waiting for something to just come along and go, wow, that's really phenomenal what they're doing this year, and make a big splash.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
Station. Yeah.
Hasn't happened in a while. Okay, so what does next year look like? What's your bucket list for the year?
This year, I want to actually, I'm trying to stay home more. I want to keep working on my studio stuff and getting a lot of records. I'm actually now working on Frank Gambale's new record. They're actually doing vocals while I'm out here. My assistant is recording some vocals for them. It's his wife and his project, and really great stuff. And, you know, Frank is like to guitar players, like Dave Weckl to drummers.
Yeah.
So I'm very excited about that. But I want to keep working and trying to cultivate a higher level clients now, you know, some things that are a little more notable. And the reason being is in the last, when I had my old studio where we met, Sonora Recorders on Los Feliz, you know, just fighting to get paid from the record companies and waiting 6 months to get a check, you know, for $500. I bailed on the Hollywood machine and started with the independents, which has done great for me with all my jazz clients and stuff. But I'm not going to get a Taylor Swift record by doing that, you know. So I'm trying to get a little more focused and trying to get some more high-profile pop artists in and seeing what I can do. And I'm getting a lot of interesting inquiries. So hopefully that's one thing that'll happen this year for me. I'd like to, if I do some touring, I'd like to go to some interesting places. I've been to Europe probably 10 years of my life. I've spent over there touring, which is great. But how many times can you go to Dusseldorf before you've seen it? You know, beautiful city. But I'd like to go to, I'm offered a tour for October with Keiko Matsui, where it's an orchestra date where we're doing 14 cities in Russia from the West Coast to the East Coast, including Vladivostok and places. I think that would be fascinating.
Yeah.
Something like that I pursue. There's another artist, African artist from Senegal, Baba Mall is his name.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
One of the big things. I did a show for him at the photo. There's in West LA, there's a photo gallery museum. It's a plaza, and they have concerts there every year. KCRW, Brandenburg Photo Museum or something. It's in West LA, and they had KCRW puts on shows. I got hired to mix his band there, and in doing so, I've already gotten two mixing projects and have been told that they want to bring me to Senegal to do some stuff over there. That would be fascinating. South Africa, I've been to a few times, but to go back again, it's always incredible. Australia, South America, any of the places that are a little off the beaten path. You know, we always go to Europe and, you know, and South America is half the distance, you know, from us. We can be in Peru and time it takes to get to New York. But, you know, that would be, for me, would be a nice new adventurous way to spend the next year. So I'm trying to focus on cultivating some of those kind of gigs and, you know, pursuing the clients that are doing those. So that's something that I'll probably be trying to do this year.
Well, very cool. Well, thank you for helping me celebrate the anniversary here of the podcast. And next year we'll do it again and we'll catch up and hopefully you'll be able to tell me about some of these places.
I hope so. Yeah, it'd be great. Yeah, definitely. We'll keep in touch. Always good to see you. And I'm not waiting until next year to see you.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, you know, I bought a house in the desert a few years ago, and I don't get to spend much time out there, but that's the thing I'd like to do is try and get out there at least a few days a month instead of, you know, once every few months. It's a beautiful house and it's very peaceful out there. You should come out and hang out sometime. And if you want a little getaway, come on out. Big place, beautiful, beautiful community, and a lot of interesting music stuff going on out there too. So it's nice. It's not Hollywood, but it's a nice little break. And, you know, so that's on my list too. So let's keep in touch. Absolutely.
You got it. For more info on Dennis, go to DennisMoody.com. It's all one word, Dennis Moody, M-O-O-D-Y.com. Thanks for listening and being my inner circle for these last 3 years. Hopefully you'll be listening for many more. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@BobbyOInnerCircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to BobbyOsinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to BobbyOInnerCircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At BobbyOsinski.com and BobbyOInnerCircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.